Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Before we hear from Barbara Damrosch of Four Season Farm, we return to our interview with Ashoka Bandaraji, author of Sustainability and Well-Being, as she describes the complex role of technology, poverty, and collapse.
Which is not to say that technology and the market don't have their place. And in fact, there are certain groups of people, particularly those who underconsume, who are in poverty-stricken situations, who need to consume more. And I think we need to have a middle path where there is more balance between the underconsumption of certain groups and the hyper-consumerism of certain other groups. And also in terms of technology, having a more balanced approach to technology, renewable sources of energy and alternatives to chemical pesticides, so on and so forth.
Yes, a less harmful technology, but still we can be smart about it. Now, in the legend of your namesake, the Emperor Ashoka, the supreme ruler, came to a recognition point and began social change to benefit all. Now, I personally doubt the most powerful groups in our time show any signs of making that transition. And if they don't, where does our hope come from?
I think it comes from professionals and middle-class people and educating people and consciousness, because the systems that we have in place are the products of human consciousness and thinking. And I think that people need to realize, and I think more and more individuals are realizing, that it is a very destructive path that we are on, a suicidal path. And rather than identifying with it in a very individualistic, competitive way that somehow we can survive in it, even if the environment is collapsing all around us and human societies are collapsing, rather to sort of really exercise our own power and try to take more leadership and provide direction. And I think in doing that, we also have to think about intergenerational justice. We have to think about the generations down the road. And that's where sort of a Native American thinking, for example, seventh generation sustainability, making decisions, taking into account the well-being of seven generations to come. And I think in this transformation of consciousness and social change, the so-called middle groups, professionals, intellectuals, have a very important role to play, because those who are at the very bottom are just trying to survive from day to day. They have hardly anything to eat, no shelter, no health care, so on and so forth. But those groups in the middle, rather than trying to identify with the 1%, so to speak, I think need to exercise their freedom of expression and really take a broad look at, you know, where we are headed, which means we have to really emphasize interdependence, because I think that is the one thing that I emphasize mostly in the book, that the problem is not even globalization or capitalism or communism as much as dualism. That is, we think in terms of self versus other rather than thinking in terms of interdependence, our connection with each other and the connectedness to nature, that we are, in fact, part of nature rather than separate from it.
Well, Ashoka Bandaraji, you draw from the tradition of Buddhism. Is it possible to reduce our mental suffering and still be activists working for change?
Absolutely, because being on a spiritual path, if you want to put it that way, is not sitting on a cushion meditating. While, you know, that is increasingly important, that kind of sort of inner reflection and inner development is essential. But also, how do we practice that on an ongoing basis in terms of our relationships to each other and how we live in the world? So Buddhism has, and I think many other spiritual traditions, have never been just about ritual or sort of individual self and advancement. I think it is about the community and our relationships to each other. So in that sense, the psychosocial transformation that I talk about in the book needs to be emphasized.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is author, scholar, and journalist Ashoka Bandaraji. Ashoka, in your book, Sustainability and Well-Being, you suggest our social movements are not enough and not working in the right directions. What is the problem?
Well, I have looked at environmental movements and social justice movements, and there is a historical tradition of these movements not always working together. And I, for example, give the case of ecofascism, where certain green movements, while they have upheld environmental sustainability, have actually worked against social justice and have stood not only for discrimination, but even genocide of certain groups. Just take the example of Nazi ecofascism. So I think it's important to bring these movements together, and certainly there are many movements trying to do so. But I think it is an environmental justice movement, particularly given the fact that it is people of color, people in the South, and poor communities who bear the brunt of environmental destruction more than privileged groups, although when it comes to environmental collapse, you know, it affects us all.
Well, before we return to the nagging problem of our destructive inner dialogue, I'm wondering if we can ground this a little bit in your own country of Sri Lanka. I know you are very familiar with the West, having taught in several American universities, but we know little to nothing about Sri Lanka other than it's near India, it was called Ceylon, and suffered both a tsunami and a civil war. Why not tell us how Western chemical companies affect the lives of the poorest people of Sri Lanka?
Yes, I'm glad you're raising that question because, you know, the tsunami and the civil war have received global attention. But things like chronic kidney disease that is rampant, widespread among agricultural communities, particularly in the north central province and in Sri Lanka, is really little known outside of the country. And very large percentages of the agricultural population, farmers, have been affected by kidney disease, and even the WHO, the World Health Organization, has attributed the chronic kidney disease to widespread use of chemical pesticides, you know, agrochemicals. And studying this issue, I found that this is not a problem peculiar to Sri Lanka, that in Central America, particularly in Nicaragua, and also the agricultural areas of India, that there is also similar cases of kidney disease that are suspected to be linked to widespread use of pesticides. And oftentimes these pesticides are things that have been banned in the industrialized north, and it is the poor, again, you know, who are mostly victimized by such diseases. But on the other hand, you know, the food and the products that create, you know, get circulated across the world, and certainly through the global economic trade and the ecosystem, it also comes back to the north. So again, you know, there is that interconnectedness of these environmental and public health issues.
And you've brought us back to the big picture. Now, various Western authors say our habit of domination began with agriculture and civilizations of the ancient Middle East. Those cultures damaged their environment, while native Indian cultures in the Americas apparently did not. Where in that picture does the ancient Asian culture fit into this discussion?
In Sri Lanka, there was a hydraulic civilization prior to European colonialism. People who have studied this, including some of my colleagues, have pointed out that the irrigational systems that were used at that time were actually more sustainable than the kinds of new irrigational infrastructure that have been introduced through World Bank and other Western-funded organizations that have involved, you know, massive dam building and massive infrastructure, displacement of population, so on and so forth. So even there's a lot of lessons to be learned from pre-modern traditions of agriculture and cultivation. And also those systems were not the monocultural crop production like that was introduced by the British with, say, tea plantation. You know, they were more diversified agricultural production, which included, you know, rotating the soil, rotating the different areas that were cultivated with different plants over time, and certainly the use of more natural pesticides.
Well, I'm worried about Sri Lanka because, as we learned from the tsunami, so many people lived right along the coast and depend upon it for their survival. And yet with rising seas, we're going to see more violent storms and higher waters washing over. I know Sri Lanka is also a very mountainous country. There are places to go, but it's hard to see how your country will adapt to climate change.
Yeah, I'm glad you're raising that issue because just south to Sri Lanka are the Maldives, which are, you know, hundreds of atolls, and they are predicted to go under. And in fact, the Maldivian government has been talking about relocating their entire population elsewhere. And Sri Lanka, too, is an island, and many of the coastal areas have been repopulated again, I mean, the coastal belt. And also the kind of tourism, and although sometimes it's referred to as ecotourism, is also putting a toll on the coastal belt. And I don't think there is, you know, enough attention being given to these looming problems, you know, despite the devastation that was caused by the tsunami a few years ago. And also there is, massive deforestation, and in the name of development, like in many other parts of the world, for example, the elephant population is being wiped out because their homes, the forest is being destroyed.
That makes me very sad to hear that. Now, I would like to get a more concrete grasp on this idea of the middle path for our listeners. We're busy. We want specifics. What can we do with this idea of the middle path?
Yeah, the middle path, I think that when we talk about sustainability and simple living and cutting down on consumption, particularly in the West in terms of meat consumption, people get very scared and they feel threatened. And I think it is important to point out that it is not about going back to our foraging history, where we spent 99% of our lives as human beings, and there was a kind of stasis. There was no material technological development at that time. And I don't think that sustainability calls for that. But on the other hand, sustainability also is not compatible with unbridled growth. I think there's got to be regulation. There's got to be limitations on the kind of technology that we use, limitations on use of fossil fuel, and, you know, limits on consumption. And to get to that point of a middle path, a balance, I think it's about living in balance with nature and not disturbing the natural equilibrium of nature, which is not to say that nature doesn't change, but we are changing nature in such a rapid pace that it is collapsing around us. So I think it is not to say that we should have no growth, like some conservationists and radical environmentalists would say. So I think that is where the middle path comes in. It is not a complete no to growth, but it is a more balanced growth, rational use of resources, and solar technology, wind technology, as opposed to, say, the Keystone Pipeline, for example. So I think that is where it comes in, that it's an alternative to unbridled growth and no growth, but it has to be a much more conscious process, which involves a kind of an inner transformation where we have to ask, what are our needs? And putting more energy in terms of our social development and our inner development, not just the technological and material development.
Well, you've given us a lot of powerful ideas, I think. My guest has been Ashoka Bandaraji, appearing in the Huffington Post and author of at least 5 books. Her latest is Sustainability and Well-Being. If you want to travel outside ideas that are not working, give her book a try. Find her at bandaraji.com, spelled Bandarage. Thank you so much, Ashoka, for joining us.
Thank you, Alex, and keep up the good work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This is Alex Smith with Radio EcoShock. Now, the New York Times called her the Queen of Organic Growers. She has a weekly column in the Washington Post and numerous television appearances with husband Elliot Coleman. They run Four Season Farm in Harborside, Maine. Barbara Damrosch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
I interviewed Elliot a couple of years ago, I think it was, and 2 things really stuck in my mind about greenhouse gardening, and one was keep it in the ground, not up on these raised planting tables.
We grow in the soil.
Right.
No need to have these benches.
And it works out for a lot of reasons. We could talk about that at length, I'm sure. And the thing that I think is particularly intriguing to me now, talking with you today, is the idea of, all right, you've grown these particular greens that will grow in the climate that we've got. How are you going to really eat them? How are you going to prepare them? How are you going to get them into the kitchen? And that's the topic of your new book, I believe.
Yes, yes. Half of the book is growing and half of it is cooking.
Okay, so what's the title of the book?
The Four Season Farm Gardener's Cookbook. We were sort of emphasizing the cookbook part because it's the first time we've ever done a cookbook. And so people have been asking us for years, when are you going to do a cookbook? Especially me, because I always, when I lecture, I always show pictures of things I've cooked. And so we finally did it.
What do you think are some of the vegetables that we can grow ourselves that present a challenge to make them interesting and table ready?
I think almost anything that you have an awful lot of is a challenge because you're eating it every day. Like, for instance, we're in asparagus season right now back home. And the first time you pick it, it's just like, oh, I haven't tasted asparagus since last year. And it's so wonderful. And then but you're going to go and pick it for 6 weeks and make the most of that wonderful season. So the more you can do to think of different ways of cooking it, the better. And I think that's true of everything. So like, I will steam it with butter very simply, and I'd be happy to eat it that way every day. But then after a while, I'm making omelets with it or a quiche with it or, you know, maybe creamed on toast or something like that. And a lot of the recipes I have are ones like the ones I just mentioned that I could use with something else that's in season. So maybe 3 months from now, I'd be putting leeks in all those recipes.
You know, I think you can almost overdo it when things do come in. I just went on a rhubarb binge, and then I realized I had a little bit too much rhubarb. It's a very strong vegetable.
It certainly is. In fact, it's not my favorite thing. And we have grown it. I have definitely grown it. I have cooked with it. And there are ways of making it delicious, but it's not for everybody. I think it has to be sweetened a lot. It is very tart.
Definitely. So you're getting some sugar. What happens with your food diet in the kitchen when it's wintertime in Harborside, Maine?
Well, we have so many things that we grow fresh that we don't just rely on storage crops. I mean, we have all of those too. You know, we store potatoes and carrots and beets and turnips and winter squash. But at the same time that we have, for instance, storage carrots, we have fresh dug carrots that we can pull all winter long up until the point where they start to regrow. So about mid-February, they start to send up new foliage and taste less sweet. But spinach will grow all winter long. Baby leaf crops like arugula, mosh, the small lettuces. Anything is more winter hardy if you grow it at a baby leaf size. And the advantage to that as well is that you can keep picking it and it'll keep producing.
I spoke with a professor from Guelph University. They have an agricultural college
there.
Yes,
we've spoken there.
Yes. Well, he operated a greenhouse, and one of the things he told me was that for some of his crops, they weren't really growing very much, and in fact, he didn't water them at all. It was almost like a method of storing fresh food so that you could pick it right there and put it on the table fresh, as opposed to, okay, I'm going to get a big crop out of this.
That's so well said. In fact, one person once described our farm as a giant crisper drawer in the refrigerator. Because basically, the way you time these crops is that you plant them until they attain harvestable size at just about the point where it becomes very cold and their growth is going to slow down. So they will sit there from maybe, in our case, October into early February in suspended animation. They won't die, but they won't get any bigger either. So basically, we apportion out the bed. So we're allowed to pick, say, this many feet of spinach this week and then another 10 feet or whatever it is the following week. Because we're marketing these, of course, not just in our case, where it's not just for home consumption, although it is too.
Well, there are people starting up their home businesses on not very big pieces of land.
Isn't that wonderful? And these are the wonderful crops to do that with. It's a nice little niche crop that, you know, fresh food that most people don't think is available, or maybe is shipped from all the way across the world or something like that.
Yeah, I interviewed one fellow. He had a city lot. Now, this was in California, but he was selling to specialty restaurants and making a reasonable living from it.
Well, we can get $140,000 gross of vegetables off of an acre and a half. So that at least, so that's at least 80,000 an acre. That's very high yields.
You have stunned me. I had no idea that was possible.
It can. And there's a lot of labor involved with it, but we're working on that. Elliot has a lot of tools in the pipeline that mechanize the small farm to just the degree that you don't have to hire as many people.
Well, talking about the labor idea, now, everybody wants to grow their own food, I think, or a lot of our listeners do for sure, but they also have busy lives, you know, they're raising kids, they're trying to make a living somehow as well. Is it possible to raise a portion of your own food, or is that something we have to leave for our future dreams?
Well, I think it depends on your time and your space. Those are the dual constraints. And this book, we were very, very conscious of trying to help people solve that problem. You know, first of all, we talk about what you can do if you only have a garden the size of your dining table, say. You know, there's quite a bit you can grow if you do cut and come again crops, succession crops, interplanting. It takes a certain amount of strategy. But then we also tell people how to have a big garden if they want to go and really do it. And there's a lot of tricks there, again, for saving space and saving time. So you never let any part of the garden go blank. It's like on radio. You don't want dead air. You don't want dead space in a garden. And we have lots of tricks for just doing everything more quickly. We have a rake with little markers that let you go zip down a bed and then zip the other way and make a planting grid for transplants that would take you so much longer if you were stretching out strings and measuring tapes. This is just almost instant. Same in the kitchen. I have all kinds of recipes that are much quicker than the traditional equivalent. So, for instance, I make a quiche. I don't make a pastry crust, and that's a nuisance. I mean, it's fun, but it takes time. You don't always have time to do that. So it's just I smear the pan with butter, and I shake buckwheat groats, and that lines it. And then you just put your filling in, and the moisture in the filling cooks the wonderful sort of nutty crust. And so it's just so easy and so fast.
I want to try that.
Well, there you go. There you go. I have a cake where instead of having to make a frosting, you just use flavored whipped cream and whatever fruit's in season and flavor the cream according to what the fruit is. And you know, create your own moment for that recipe based on what you have, even if it's just some marmalade you've put up or something like that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Barbara Damrosch. And I want to make a shout-out to any young mothers out there and young fathers. For heaven's sakes, teach your boys how to cook. We've got a whole generation being raised up on, they're ending up on fast food, and it's bad for everybody's health. What's your feeling about this? How are we going to get men cooking?
Well, that's a good question. And it's funny because my son grew up loving to cook. I mean, he was a macho kid. He was a good at a lot of sports. He was a big guy, you know, all of that. So he wasn't threatened by the fact that he was interested in cooking. And so he signed up for his high school home ec class. He enjoyed it a lot. And I mean, he taught them how to make hollandaise sauce in a blender. You know, it was wonderful. And he still cooks up a storm. My husband, Elliot, is not the cook of the family, but there's certain things that he's really good at doing. He's good at making stir fries and scrambled eggs, and he makes wonderful little pizzas out of tortillas or chapatis. I don't know how you do it. You just hopefully get them hooked, maybe through the taste. I don't know.
I think it's partly a generational thing, too, though. I think if we can get the kids cooking when they're young, they're going to do a lot better.
Sure. Well, take the time. Instead of saying, get out of the kitchen, I'm busy, you know, just show them a few things.
Yeah, get them up on the counter measuring out the flour, whatever you got to do.
Right, right.
Yeah. So what are you going to tell people at the Mother Earth News Fair when you do your presentation?
Well, I'm just going to show them a few time-saving tricks, but I'm also going to just show what a pleasure it is to eat with the seasons. You know, as Americans, we think we're entitled to walk into a supermarket and have anything we want on any day of the year. Bring in a recipe, you can find every single ingredient right there. Whereas we want the garden to inspire the recipe, because the real luxury for us, the real entitlement, is to get that vegetable or fruit, whatever it is, at the moment where it's perfect. So instead of, you know, being satisfied with melons that were ripened a long time ago in artificial conditions, like the melons I had this morning in a hotel, you know, breakfast, it was pretty awful. I'm waiting for the real melons that we get ourselves at the end of the season in Maine. And it's just, it's an ecstatic experience to have that flavor that you've waited for.
Right. You know, tomatoes are such a disappointment to me. Wherever you find them, they don't taste like tomatoes anymore. I've read that they've been bred for shipping.
Yeah, they've been bred for shipping. Yeah, forgotten to breed flavor into them. They're uniform. They're tough-skinned. They're not very interesting. Often produce is ripened by ethylene gas as opposed to natural ripening. I don't think that gives you particularly good flavor.
Yeah, or they ship it totally green, and eventually it ripens, but you might get it a month later.
Sun-ripened is the way to go.
It is, and there's nothing like a peach when that's in season.
That's right. We have a two-week peach season. We can only grow one variety in Maine. It's hardy, called Reliance. It's not a particularly great peach, but it's our peach. And we enjoy it when it happens.
I didn't know you could grow peaches in Maine. But things are also changing. The plant hardiness map has been changed because of climate change.
Right.
Things are warming up, and there's more stress for some people as far as drought goes for their plants. It's a challenging time to be a gardener.
Yes, it's unpredictable. The trouble with what we're experiencing with climate is that it's a lot of crazy extremes.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, we're having a very cold spring. We did last year, too.
Yeah, and then you got the tremendous floods with, was it Irene, Hurricane Irene? So much rain came.
Yeah, it's all or nothing.
They had 10 inches in San Antonio a few weeks ago. That's a lot of rain for San Antonio,
Texas.
Yeah, what
do you do with it all? My goodness.
It just floods everything out, including your garden. And I think people have to be a little more aware when they set up their gardens about how they're going to deal with either a lot of rainfall or none.
That's a good point.
You know, and your water management. It's really important.
That may be collected into a pond or something.
Yeah, or the rain barrels.
Rain barrels are perfect. Go right off your roof. Yeah. Although in Colorado, you're not allowed to do that.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, because it's part of the conservation that they want the earth to absorb the water.
Well, I heard a different story. I heard that in some states, at least, somebody's bought the water rights, say, to the river or whatever, and the rain is what's supposed to feed it.
That could be part of it, too.
To tell somebody you can't collect the rain that falls on your own property.
Isn't it?
Have you got a new book that you're working on or a new project in the works?
No, I'm taking a little rest. I'm going to be doing some writing and photography for Mother Earth News magazine. One reason I was delighted to come to their fair today. And I have a great respect for that magazine. They seem to go more into depth about everything and just take it a little further. I get a lot of information from it. So anyway, I'm going to be writing for them and just really working on the farm, giving it all I've got.
Right. And do you have a blog with Mother Earth News or your own blog? Or?
No, I'm going to be starting a series, but it won't start until next summer, about cooking and growing. Similar to the material in the book. But I'm writing an article right now that'll come out, I think it's early fall, about the best varieties and types of plants to grow in cold weather.
Great. And how about giving us the website as we finish up?
It's fourseasonfarm.com, and that's fourseasonfarm.com. So no S at the end of season, no S at the end of farm.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. It's been a pleasure to have Barbara Damrosch on the show.
Thank you so much, Alex. A great pleasure of mine.
Find more links to all our guests in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. My thanks to the Mother Earth News for arranging some great interviews at the recent fair in Puyallup, Washington. Special thanks to all the listeners who donated at our blog or website so I could afford to get my recording gear to the fair. Become part of the program yourself at www.ecoshock.org.